This is Ron Stockton.
Well, this is the third of these big wars. The first was the Suez War, and then came the 1967 War, and now we're looking at the 1973 War, which is called the Yom Kippur War, if you're an Israeli. Or maybe it's called Ramadan War or Badr, if you're an Egyptian. And it's called Tishrin, which means October. So if you're a Syrian, so this is sometimes called the October War or the 1973 War. Those are neutral terms. So actually the October War, which the Syrians use, that's a neutral term for us. So we don't have to worry about taking sides. The attack occurred during the time of Yom Kippur, which is a big Jewish holiday. We'll talk about that in a minute. Because Golda Meir, the American Israeli prime minister, she grew up in Milwaukee and was a teacher before she made Aliyah. That means she immigrated. And Aliya, we'll talk about that later when we talk about Zionism. We'll talk about that term. The 1973 war is built into the 1967 war, the same way World War II is built into the end of World War I. At the end of World War I, you look at Germany's humiliation and you say, you know, they're just not going to put up with that very long. And the treaties that were worked out, Versailles and all of those bad treaties, no country would accept that if they had an alternative. The same thing was true with the 1973 war. It's obvious the Arabs were not going to accept the humiliating defeat of 1967. And so Syria and Egypt, from the very beginning, they started preparations for the next war. They began coordinating, merging their military commands, trying to create a joint effort that would succeed this time. Nasser died in 1970. I remember that event very well. I was living in Kenya. I was doing field research for my doctorate, and I was in a taxi cab. I went by taxi from where I lived at the base of Mount Kenya to the town of Nyeri, which is what, 5 miles away. And I was in a taxi, and it was on the news that Nasser had died. And then we got to town and we saw that the flags were down. We're at half mast. So that was the event. He was the great hero of the Arab people. So the champion of the Arabs. So without Nasser, what was going to happen? Well, he was succeeded constitutionally by his vice president, Anwar Sadat, or al-Sadat, S-A-D-A-T. And Sadat was one of the original free officers. You remember that? And people made jokes about him because he was very subservient to President Nasser. So people called him a kind of a nickname, Vice President Nam Nam. N-A-A-M means yes. So it's like, yes, sir, whatever you want, sir. Yes, sir, very good idea, sir. It was as if he didn't have any ideas of his own. Whatever Nasser wanted, that's what he wanted. So when he became president, there were a lot of people who said, okay, let's push this guy aside and get in someone who's tough. They really underestimated Sadat. There were three coup attempts against him, and he just crushed them all. He was really smart. In Syria, there was the commander of the Air Force was named Assad, Hafez al-Assad, A-S-S-A-D. I've seen that spelled with one S, A-S-A-D, but it's typically spelled with two. Assad. And he was a Nasserist. He really admired Nasser. And when Nasser died, he looked at the president of Syria and he said, this man is a mediocrity. He's a loser. So he organized a coup, removed this person, locked him up under house arrest. And I think he stayed there the rest of his life. He didn't kill him. And didn't send him into exile, but kept him locked up. So now we have two new leaders. In Egypt and Syria. I should mention, by the way, the story of Nasser's death. There was a real, he died in 1970. There had been a terrible fighting in Jordan with the Palestinians, and the Palestinians had suffered greatly. And he was trying to work out, Nasser was trying to work out, he set up a conference and he brought all the leaders to Cairo. And he said, okay, we're going to work out a problem, a solution for these refugees. They shouldn't have to be driven from country to country. They shouldn't be massacred. So they worked out an arrangement to move the Palestinian armies, not the Palestinian populations, because there's a lot of Palestinians in Jordan, which we'll talk about later. But they moved the Palestinian armies from Jordan, where they had led an uprising against the king, to be honest. And that produced what is called Black September. That's a Palestinian term, obviously, when there were a lot of massacres. And Nasser had gone to the airport. This man didn't sleep for a couple of days. He went to the airport. Every single time a leader arrived, he would go to the airport, pick him up personally, bring him to the negotiating center, then go back and get another leader. Then he engaged in negotiations. And then after days of negotiation, he took every single Arab leader back to the airport personally. It would have been quite proper for him just to say a goodbye at the palace or whatever. But he wanted to show them full respect. So he took each one, all of those 20 some Arab leaders. And when he came back from dropping off the very last one, he had a heart attack. It was a heroic death. It was as if he had died in battle fighting for the Palestinians. So Sadat, really smart guy. Now, do you remember that Egypt had signed a security arrangement with the Soviet Union? They got a lot of weapons, but they also got soldiers. Russian soldiers were based in Egypt. Not the way the British had been. The British were there as an occupying army, but the Russians were there as a welcoming security force, and they were kept on their bases. They didn't try to control the political system. They were there for military purposes. The same way the U.S. Army in Germany, even today, is not there to interfere with German politics. We're just there for security reasons. In 1972, Sadat made a really smart observation. He realized that if a war started and the Russian army, or a part of it, was in Egypt, This would immediately be seen as a Cold War issue. He didn't want it to be a Cold War issue. He wanted it to be an issue between Egypt and Syria and Israel over the fact that Israel was occupying Syrian and Egyptian and Palestinian territory. So he had the Russians leave. He said, I want all of you to leave. He did this politely. He didn't just kick them out. But so they had a farewell dinner and they all said lovely things about each other and what great, this is an alliance for the ages. And oh, I don't know, you can imagine. And they gave each other gifts and it's wonderful. And then Sadat went to Parliament and delivered, I guess what you would call the State of the Union speech, like his big speech once a year. And so he banged his fist down. Let me bang my fist down. There you go. Hear that? He banged his fist down and he said, this is the year of decision. And everybody cheered hysterically. They knew what that meant. That was the year we're going to fix the catastrophe of 1967. We are going to advance the Arab cause. We're going to restore Arab dignity. We are going to get the Palestinians a good shake. And what happened? Well, it's interesting. We got to see what happens in Israel. The Prime Minister of Israel was Golda Meir. I mentioned that. She was kind of a tough lady. And so she called her cabinet together. And they said, what does this mean? Year of decision. Well, everybody said, we know what this means. This means they're going to attack and try to get the Sinai back. That's what that means. And you can count on the Syrians trying to get the Golan back. And you can count on the Jordanians trying to get the West Bank back. So we got to get ready for war. Now, here's something to remember about the Israeli military. It's a citizen army and everybody serves. If you are a religious female, you don't have to serve. And if you are an Orthodox, a student in yeshiva, a seminary studying the Torah, you don't have to serve, which makes a lot of people really irritated because those students tend to be very right-wing. They say, oh, you always want to have a war, but you just don't want to be in it. And so what do we call them in this country? Chicken hawks. They're hawks, but they don't want to serve, right? And so on any given day, very few Israelis are actually in uniform. When you graduate from high school, you go into the military, everybody serves. You serve for a year and a half, maybe. I've forgotten the exact time. If you're a guy, maybe if you're a female, you serve a year. I don't know. But you do service. And then you go into long-term reserve. And the reservists get called up, you know, once a month. They have to go to meetings and practices and lectures and all that kind of thing. But on any given day, they're not in uniform. So in 1973, on any given day, Israel would have about 175,000 soldiers in uniform. But they would have 445,000 people in reserve. I think by the time you get to be in your 40s, you go into inactive reserve. They can kind of use you in offices if there's a war, but you're not going to be in combat uniform again. So they're kind of adapt to that. I have a couple stories about this, actually. I was in Jerusalem once and I dropped my camera. And it looked okay, but I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to be here for a whole month. And if this camera lens is, or the mirror is off center, then all of my photos are going to be damaged. And so I took it to a camera shop. There was a nice guy there, and I told him what happened. He says, "Okay, I'll check it out. Looks okay, but I'll check it out. Come back tomorrow." So I came back tomorrow, and there's a different guy there. And I said, "Okay, where's the camera guy?" He says, "Oh, he got called up. His unit got called up." And I said, "What's the issue? I didn't see anything in the news about like attacks or anything like that." It was kind of a quiet time. He says, "I don't know. They got called up." And I said, "When will he be back?" He said, "I don't know. He could be back tomorrow. He could be back in a month. I don't know." Well, this is what happens when you get called up. That happened to be short term. They just got called up and then they got sent back. But this is what happened. Suddenly the economy is disrupted, isn't it? I talked to a professor who at Hebrew University who told me about teaching a seminar. Now, in a seminar, a PhD seminar, all the students present their research. That's the professor's not lecturing, the students present their research. So he said, "You know, there's two odd things about teaching a research seminar." He says, first thing, and he did international relations, that was his field, comparative politics and conflict and things like that. He said, "The thing is, every single person in my class has been in combat. So when I talk about war, everybody's got a story. Suddenly these theories make sense to them and they can critique them or whatever." And he said, "The second thing is, typically in a seminar, the professor will create a schedule and say, 'Okay, next Tuesday in the seminar, you're presenting your research, and then the following Tuesday, someone else is.'" He said, "When I go in there, I don't know that the person who is in charge of the class that day is actually going to show up. He may have been called up." So this is very unpre so calling up the reserves for future war, we're back to the day of the year of decision, right? The Israeli cabinet met and they said, "Okay, we better get ready for this. The Egyptians are getting ready. The Syrians are getting ready. We better get ready." So they called up their reserves. So they all got in their uniforms and they all went to the front lines and sat there waiting. Nothing happened. So after a period of time, a month, I don't know how long it was, they sent them all home. They said, "Okay, you guys go back home. And women too, go back home." Let's go back to 1967. Everybody, including the Israelis, knew there was going to be another war to correct what happened in 1967. So they had to prepare their defenses. Now, remember, they occupied the whole Sinai, so their territory actually touched the Suez Canal. So they put a general named Bar-Lev in control of security, Bar hyphen Lev. Now, if you've got that list of words that I gave you printed out there, you'll not have trouble with these names. But Bar-Lev is a very famous person because he looked around. I actually attended his memorial service. I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but I was in Jerusalem. And so I went to the Knesset. I thought, "Okay, I'll observe the Knesset." And usually, they're just doing routine business. And I was sitting there in the balcony, and in came all the famous people, Begin, Rabin, Netanyahu. They were all there. I thought, "This is amazing. This is the whole lineup of everybody I've ever heard about is there." Well, it turned out that that was his memorial service. Of course, I didn't understand a word of it, and I didn't know what was going on until I saw in the paper the next day that this had been Bar-Lev's memorial service. He had died. So, back to 1967. Bar-Lev was put in charge of creating a defensive system. What are we going to do when the Egyptians attack? And he said, "You know, there's just sand all over the place. Why don't we just build a big barrier? It's going to be very hard for them to cross the canal. We've got very good missiles. They're going to have to move tanks across. They're going to have to move soldiers across. What if we built just like a big wall? Like in the Middle Ages, you know, they have a big wall and a moat. Okay, so the Suez is the moat, and then there's a big wall leading up to the castle. There's no castle, but you get the point. And so they spent a lot of money building this Barlev line, as it was called. And so how is Sadat going to get his army and his tanks and whatever across the Suez Canal? It's not a big canal, but you got to move those things across. And the Israelis are in a position, really a very good defensive position. So Sadat put his mind to it. And so here's what they decided. They sent a delegation to Frankfurt, and they went to this place that makes fire engines and firefighting equipment. And they said, you know, we'd like to buy some fire hoses and pumps. And the Germans said, you've come to the right place. And they said, we have some unique circumstances in Cairo, that we have some high rises and some tall buildings. And sometimes fires actually start on the top of buildings. I got to tell you this, when they finish construction, they just leave all the junk up on top. It's quite amazing. Anyway, they do. So I can see it would be credible that they might say, well, we do have fires that start on the top of the building. Okay, so we need fire hoses that and pumps that are strong enough to shoot water to the top of, say, a 10-story or 15-story building. And the Germans said, no problem. We make the strongest pumps in all of the world. And they said, oh, by the way, we need we have an unusual circumstance in Cairo. We don't have the same water system that you have. And so we often have to just take we don't have fire hydrants, for example. So we just drop a water we just drop the hose of a pump into water and pump away. So could you do that? They said, no problem, we could do that. So they bought all of these hoses and pumps. And then the second thing they did was they got a group of commandos and they trained them in swimming. Now you might think, come on, Egypt is on the Nile. Every Egyptian boy probably swims. No, they don't. It's not, the Nile is not a pleasure, or it's not a neighborhood pool or something. So a lot of Egyptians can't swim. So they took their soldiers and they took them to lakes and they taught them to swim. And then they taught them to swim with backpacks. Oh my goodness. And then they taught them to run. They said, okay, you guys are the special commandos. You're like the Green Berets. You're like Delta Force. Start running. We're not talking 5 miles. Today you're going to run 10 miles, and then within a week you're going to be running 15 miles. We're going to get you guys in great shape. So on the day of the attack, the Egyptians put large numbers of small boats out into the canal with those pumps on them, and they started spraying the Barlev line, and it began melting. The same way a sand castle, if you've ever been a kid and gone to the lake or whatever, and you built a sand castle, and as soon as the water comes up, it hits the sand castle and it melts. So they began melting the Barlev line, and they melted holes in it. Those holes are still there. I've been through one of them. It's just the road goes through it. And the Barlev line was what, 30 feet high, maybe? I don't know. I can't remember now, but it was high enough. And so the first thing they did was start melting the Barlev line. And then those commandos, those frogmen, whatever you want to call them, went across, swam across the full battle gear. That's amazing. And began attacking Israeli positions. Now, the Israelis had, I don't know, dozens of small military fortifications along the line, all way up and down the line. And the Egyptians began attacking them. So they would have like a crew of four or five Egyptian commandos, and they would go to one of these Israeli sites, and they would begin firing on it from all directions. They wouldn't all stand together. They would be in a circle around the site, and they fired. And then as soon as the Israelis got hysterical being awake and whatever, and having fire coming down on them, the Egyptians would run top speed to the next Israeli position and begin firing. So what happened back in Tel Aviv, military headquarters, was that they began getting hysterical calls from dozens of positions saying, "We're under attack. There's a massive Egyptian force." There, it wasn't a massive Egyptian force, it was just commandos. But they were attacking in a way that made it seem that there must be thousands of them all over the place. And the Israelis didn't know what to do. And the Egyptians had some very nice SAMs. Do you know what a SAM is? Surface-to-air missile. So the Russians had given them these very nice surface-to-air missiles, which meant that the Israelis had a great air force. Thank you, Uncle Sam. And so if they had started flying their planes over and to the Egyptian side, they would have been shot down. So the Egyptians controlled a certain amount of land right against the Suez Canal. So even though the Israelis were physically in control of it, they didn't control the airspace, and they were under attack. And as soon as those holes were blown in the Bar-Lev line, the Egyptians moved large numbers of tanks across and very large numbers of soldiers. They moved the whole Third Army, the Egyptian Third Army, which is the enormous army. So they moved the Third Army across and began fighting the Israelis. And the Israelis were driven back at all positions. So let me see, do I have any numbers here? Wait a minute. Here we go. My numbers. On the first day, 8,000 Egyptian soldiers crossed over. More on subsequent days, but the first day they had 8,000 Egyptians in the Sinai fighting the Israelis face to face. And they blew 10 holes. They called them bridges. They blew 10 holes in the Bar-Lev line so they could move those tanks across and the soldiers at different places. And the Israelis had 290 tanks in the region. I think I just got these numbers from Tesla or from someone. And they had 290 tanks. By the end of the first day, the Egyptians had destroyed two-thirds of them. So this was like a reversal of 1967, wasn't it? When the Israelis got the lead, sorry, the Egyptians got the lead and were driving back the Israelis on all points. Moshe Dayan, Dayan, and Moshe, Moshe, Moshe Dayan, the not the Minister of Defense. He was the commander of the Israeli army, a very famous war hero. The Americans loved him. He had that patch over his eye, you know, because he got blown out in the 1948 war. So he looked kind of like a mysterious guy, a pirate or something. I don't know. Anyway, he's a very impressive looking guy and a very strong guy. And then he held a press conference in Tel Aviv. And he said, he broke down in tears. Press conference in English, of course. All the American press were there, everybody. He broke down, emotional, broke down. And he said, there is nothing between the Egyptian Third Army and Tel Aviv. We don't have anything. We can't stop them. They can do whatever they want. Well, of course, Sadat had no intention of attacking Tel Aviv. What he wanted to do was set up a position inside of the Sinai so that this would create an international crisis. The Americans and the Russians would both get all excited and be threatening each other, and suddenly they would both realize this is not worth a war between the two of us. And there would be, and the Americans would step in, the world community would step in and force a settlement. That's what Sadat wanted. He didn't have any plans to attack Tel Aviv, but the Israelis thought he might. I mean, you have to think about that. Yitzhak Rabin, R-A-B-I-N, and his first name is Yitzhak, Y-I-T-Z-A-K, Yitzhak. Yitzhak Rabin, who was the Minister of Defense, actually had a nervous breakdown. There was a time he just disappeared. Now, later when he ran for, when he was a candidate for prime minister, and he became prime minister in 1948. And they used that against him. His opponent said, you know, this man is emotionally unstable. He had a nervous breakdown. He can't stand pressure. And his supporters said, oh, come on. The man hadn't slept for 3 days. He was going on coffee. He had a coffee reaction. And he had to take some time out and sleep and come back. And he was back the next day. What do you mean he had a nervous breakdown? Okay, I don't know. I think he had a nervous breakdown. But maybe it was the coffee. I don't know. Whatever it was, the top two military commanders, Dayan and Rabin, both had reactions that did not inspire confidence. They kept Rabin's absence from the public, but Dayan's press conference, that was broadcast. So we got a crisis here. Two things happened that really changed everything. You know, battle plans are perfect in every way until the battle starts, and then you realize you got to just throw them away and do something different. So two things started. One, having to do with the United States, and one having to do with Egypt and Israel and the Third Army. So let's look at those two things. First, there was just a hysterical call. This war lasted for 3 weeks. Now, this is the thing about the Israelis. They got a fantastic army, but they really need a fast war. In 1967, it was wonderful. In 6 days, it was over. You send the soldiers home, get cameras fixed. Professors can hold their seminars. Okay, that's okay, good. 3 weeks, that the whole Israeli military stops. Large numbers of American Jews got on planes and flew, not to fight, but they wanted to be there in the offices to replace whoever it was that got called up. So there was, in the American Jewish community, there was real concern that Israel was about to go under, especially after Moshe Dayan had his press conference. So people were very concerned. Plus, there were some strategic issues here. At this point, by 1973, Israel had become an ally. And we thought, probably, I've read the memoirs, Henry Kissinger thought the Russians were behind this. No, the Russians weren't behind this. But that's what he thought. So Nixon and Kissinger, Nixon was president, Kissinger was Secretary of State, and The Secretary of Defense was a man named Schlesinger, S-C-H-L-E-S-I-N-G-E-R. Schlesinger had a Jewish heritage, but his family at this point were Christians. So he had a like a Jewish, I don't know, grandparent maybe, or parents, I don't know. Anyway, somewhere they converted to Christianity. So he was a Christian by faith, but Jewish by heritage. So that created some mixed, not mixed feelings for him, but mixed feelings for people who dealt with him, Jewish people who dealt with him and watched him. And they thought, okay, whose side is this guy on? So let me tell you what happened. Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon decided that Israel is our ally. We have to back them up. So Henry, tell Jim Schlesinger that I want him to start an air bridge. I want him to ship tanks, armored personnel carriers, all sorts of equipment to Israel. Yes, sir, Mr. President, I'll get right on it. So Kissinger contacted Schlesinger and he said, Jim, the president wants all of this equipment shipped to Israel, ASAP. Okay, Henry, I'll get on it. So a day later, Kissinger talked to Schlesinger. He said, Jim, I haven't seen any reports of shipments. Well, let me get back to you. This is not as easy as it seems to move these things. Okay, get on it. Next day, nothing was moving. Kissinger calls Schlesinger. Jim, I haven't seen any movement. Where are those tanks? Where are those armored personnel carriers? What is all that equipment? Where are the artillery? Where is everything? Well, you know what happened? Schlesinger was dragging his feet. Think about this for a minute. The U.S. Army was dragging its feet. Okay, if you're going to move 500 tanks from the U.S. military to the Israeli military, think about this. Where are those tanks going to come from? Well, I'll tell you what you're not going to do. You're not going to go to Warren, where they make tanks, and say, could you run off 500 tanks for us in the next 48 hours? Oh, yeah, no problem. No, come on. It takes a long time to make a tank. So you've got to actually go to a U.S. base to get tanks. Okay, 1973. What was going on in the world in 1973? Think. Oh, yes, Vietnam. Now, we in the public, being naive, thought that we knew we were fighting the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese. We also thought we were probably fighting China. Because, come on, after all, China's right there, it touches Vietnam. So we thought, okay, the Chinese are helping them. Now, you know who was really helping the North Vietnamese? The Soviet Union, the Russians were. The people who really counted knew that, but I didn't know that. The average person, I mean, we knew they were sympathetic, but we didn't know that probably when John McCain got shot down over North Korea, he probably got shot down by a Russian missile, maybe even fired off by a Russian officer. Who knows? The Russians were deep in there. And the Russians had the biggest army in all of Europe. Millions of men in uniform. So here's what the military thought. You know what you're asking us to do? You're asking us to strip NATO of its ability to drive away a Russian invasion so that the Israelis can keep a pile of sand. No, we're not going to do it. So that's why there was no shipment. And finally, Kissinger called up Schlesinger. He apologized for this in his memoir. He called him up and he said, Jim, If those planes aren't flying, if those tanks are being shipped, flown into Israel within by the end of the day, I'm gonna have you removed from office. I am, not the president. It's like Henry, you don't. I'm Henry Kissinger, Henry Rex. He was called Henry the King. I'm gonna have you removed as Secretary of Defense. And Schlesinger and Kissinger both. Schlesinger said in his memoir, we had some tense exchanges. There was something that happened after the fighting was over. The commander, the chair of the Joint Chiefs, was General Brown. That was his name. And he was delivering a speech somewhere, and it was all written out. You know, his aides had written it out, and he was talking about strategy and U.S. interests and whatever. And finally, he threw down the speech. He said, "You know what? This country's run by Jews. We can't even get the American point of view out." Now, I don't know what happened. Did he want to be on Meet the Press? And it got vetoed. They wouldn't let him go on Meet the Press. I want to explain what happened. And they said, "No, General, you can't go on Meet." I don't know. I really don't know what happened. I have never read anybody who explained what this outburst was. But he said, "The Jews run this country. We can't even get the American perspective out. They control the media. They control the television. They control the newspapers. The American point of view is being pushed aside in favor of the Israeli point of view." Whoa, this was the most anti-Jewish thing ever said, I think, by a top U.S. leader. And he was the chair of the Joint Chiefs. That's the top military officer. Well, he was told, "General, you got to apologize. You will apologize. If you do not apologize, you can't say this about American citizens." Especially the military. Military leaders aren't supposed to say things about anything about policy. That's not their job. So they said, "Look, General, you're either going to apologize, you're going to be removed from your position. That's it. You're going to do it today too." So he issued an apology. He didn't mean it, but he said it. So he got to keep his job. That would have been a big political crisis to remove the chair of the Joint Chiefs under these circumstances. And after he was out of office and retired, he continued to deliver speeches along this line. He was unrepentant. Oh, I got to mention a little factoid. It's very interesting. During the 67 War, there were large minority populations in Egypt. Greeks, large numbers of Greeks, large numbers of Armenians. There's a large Christian population, the Copts, COPT, which are the traditional Christians. And some of the earliest Christians were Egyptians. And there was a large Jewish population, not large, but it was there. They had synagogues, and they were prominent too. They were an impressive community. We talked about the Jewish community in terms of the Lavan affair. In 67, the war was so, the sentiments were so bitter that there were attacks on those communities. And by the end of the war, the Greek community was gone. My goodness, they had been there since the time of Cleopatra. The Greeks had always been there. It's just across the river, or just across the sea. Greece and Egypt are very close. And Alexandria was a Greek city. And the Armenians were gone. The Jews were still there. And the Christians were there. They're Egyptians. They're not seen as an immigrant community. They're actually Egyptians of the Christian faith. But there were some bad things. Sadat was aware of this. He said, okay, that is not going to happen this time. You know why that's not going to happen? Because the first person to die in this war is going to be a Christian officer. A Copt officer. He said, sir, how can we? Anybody ever seen the Americanization of Emily, in which the deranged secretary, the deranged head of the Navy decides that the first person to die in Normandy is going to be a naval officer? It's funny. It's kind of interesting, but it's funny. And so Sadat said, okay. They said, well, what if he's not the first? You don't understand me. He is going to be the first. You're going to find to me a dead Christian officer, and that is going to be the first person who died, and we're going to turn him into a blankety-blank national hero. So that's what they did. The first person to die was a Coptic officer, and they made him a hero. And they had the family. You know how this goes. This is a ritual. Like, you bring the family to the palace, they have a state funeral, all of that sort of thing. But it worked. So that was determined that the Egyptians were not going to turn on each other. Now, I told you there were two things that made this ever so complicated. The second thing had to do with the Third Army. Sadat was really smart, because he didn't want to defeat the Israelis. He wanted to drive them back, establish a position in the Sinai, and then force the world community to start a negotiation process that would get the Israelis out of his country. Then he made a mistake. And as I told you, they had SAM missiles. So the Israelis basically couldn't get to them as long as they were within that umbrella of SAM missiles. But then he made a mistake. He saw the Israelis pulling back, and there were a few strategic places out there in the middle of the desert that the Egyptians really wanted to hold. So he moved the Third Army beyond that umbrella to occupy those positions. At this point, the Israelis had mobilized their army. They were ready, and they came roaring back and pushed the Egyptians back and surrounded the Third Army. There it was, sitting in the middle of the desert, surrounded on all sides by the Israeli military and cut off from supplies. How much water do you take with you? How much food do you take with you if you're advancing? Well, you got to have supply lines to keep that supply. Now they're isolated. They don't have more supplies. They don't have the supplies of water, of food. They're isolated, and the Israelis have got them. So now what happens? Whoa, this got to be really scary. The Russians said, you do realize we have a security arrangement with Egypt. And Brezhnev, he was the premier of the Soviet Union at the time, he sent a message. He made a statement. He said, we are not going to allow the Egyptian Third Army to be destroyed. If we have to, we will intervene. We will send the Red Army into the Sinai to back up the Egyptians. Well, this is very scary. I had a student, I told this story once to a class, And I had a student there. He's older than the other students. And he came up to me during the break and told me a story. And I asked him if he would repeat it to the whole class. And he said he would. So I'm not revealing confidences here. He said, I was in the paratroops. I was a paratrooper. And he said, we were based in Frankfurt. And they told us to assemble in the airport. And we should be ready for combat. And he said, you know, when we're getting on a plane, we're boarding a plane, the guys are lying around, they're playing cards, they're reading, they're sleeping, they're talking to their friends, whatever they're doing, their backpacks are on the ground. They said to us, no, that's not the way it's going to be. You're going to have your backpacks on your back, and you're going to be standing at the door, all of you. And when you are given the command, you will not walk, you will run, and you will get onto those troop carriers. You are going into the Sinai Peninsula to fight the Red Army. And he said, we were so scared. We looked out, those planes had their engines running. They were ready to take off. We were within minutes of going to war. Now, of course, we the public were kind of watching this from a distance, and we knew how good the Israelis were because of 1967, but now things were shifting. The Israelis were being defeated, at least driven back, and now they seemed to be advancing, and the Egyptians seemed to be on the defensive, and it looked like this was going to be another rerun. And in fact, that's exactly what the Israelis said. You know what? If we can completely crush and destroy the Third Army, we will have given the Arab world another psychological blow worse than 1967. 67, we kind of caught them off guard. 1973, they caught us off guard. And if we can destroy them, we'll have 20, 30 years without a war. They will be afraid of us. So they were actually planning to destroy the Third Army. And Kissinger worked out. I didn't like Kissinger a lot, but at this point I kind of like Kissinger. Someone published his transcripts. He had the recorder going for all his phone conversations. So, and probably office conversations too. So someone transcribed all of those, and I read those. They're just so interesting. They worked out a truce. Okay, fighting stops. That's what a truce is. You agree. Okay, we're going to pull back. We're not going to fight anymore. But after the truce, the Israelis refused to back off. They were supposed to pull back and let the Third Army get its supplies. They refused to do that. And so Kissinger had discussions with the Israelis. And they said, you know, we're going to destroy the Third Army. I don't care about your truce. You're going to have a truce, but the Third Army is not coming out of here. They'll just attack us again. And Kissinger said, you know, this is a really odd. I've never heard of this, continuing a war after you've signed a truce. And the Israeli said, well, that's what we're going to do. And Kissinger said, you know, this would be an assault on American credibility. Everybody will think we're just maneuvering for you and giving you an advantage, and we'll be destroyed. Nobody will trust us anymore. And he was told, the Israeli ambassador said, well, this is what we're going to do. And he said, you know, if you do that, something is going to happen. What's going to happen? Henry, what's going to happen? Well, I can't say what's going to happen, but I tell you, something is going to happen. Henry, are you threatening me? No. I mean, this transcript was so interesting. No, I'm not threatening you. I wouldn't threaten you. We don't threaten our allies, but I'm just telling you that if you don't back off, something is going to happen. We didn't know about these negotiations. But I'll tell you what we did know. We woke up one morning and read in the newspaper. We didn't have CNN. We didn't have 24-hour news in those days. You had to wait for the newspaper. We didn't have emails, none of that. Websites, none of that. I woke up and I read that the United States had gone on worldwide nuclear alert. Oh my goodness. Worldwide nuclear alert. You know what that means? You know, we have all these missiles, but we have this idea, you know, there's always this person following the president around with a box, and that box has got the codes in it so the president can go click, 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 and phew, missiles go off and they blow up some country. It's not that simple, actually. The missiles have to be activated. You got to put the warheads in them. They're not ready. They don't want an accidental launch. Something accidentally got shot up in the air. It would land, but it wouldn't have a warhead on it. So the warheads have to be, the warhead might be there, but it wouldn't blow up. So they have to be activated before they can be fired. Kissinger activated them. We were ready to have a nuclear war. Oh my goodness. You know what I think? I think the minute that Kissinger activated those warheads was the minute that Nixon and Kissinger and the whole U.S. security force, the whole intelligence, the whole Defense Department, everybody said what Henry Kissinger said to the Israeli ambassador. We are not willing to have World War III so that you can hold on to a desert. That's what Kissinger said. And how do I know this? It's in the transcript. So we had this situation. You know what was an unanticipated side effect? You know, where were those missiles? Those missiles that we were going to fire at the Soviet Union, they weren't sitting in Detroit. They were in Germany and they were in Britain. That's where they were. And you know what we didn't tell the Germans and we didn't tell the British what we were doing. Kissinger just did it. They read it in the newspaper the same way we did, I guess. But you know what happened? A lot of Germans said, whoa, wait a minute. The Americans are ready to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union in order to protect the Israeli occupation of the Sinai. And the missiles are going to be fired from our country, and you know that the Soviet Union is going to respond by firing back. So who's going to get blown up? Germany is. Who's going to get blown up? Britain is. Why? To protect the Israelis and to advance U.S. security interests. This doesn't make sense. So overnight, there were anti-American organizations created to remove missiles, American missiles. They said, we can't trust you people. You're going to fire off missiles? Every time the Israelis get into an argument with the Egyptians, you're going to threaten the survival of Germany and the survival of Britain? You're going to use us as launching pads? No, 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 you're not. Get those missiles out of there. So this was a political setback for us in a sense. Now on the Syrian side, remember the von Schlieffen plan, right? If you had a two-front war, what you do is put all your forces on one side, you fight a holding action on one side, and you concentrate all your forces on the other side. Well, that's what the Israelis did. They fought a holding action in Syria and put all their forces into the Sinai. And what happened in Syria was that the Syrians advanced. They basically liberated all of the Golan. They liberated Quneitra. Sorry, my phone's speaking to me. I don't want my phone to speak to me. They basically liberated the whole of the Sinai, and Quneitra was a town of 50,000. And in 1967, the Israelis had, they had either fled or the Israelis expelled them. They were gone. And they were almost all living in Damascus. And so everybody in Damascus had a friend who had been kicked out of their house in Quneitra. And now President Assad went there. He hoisted the Syrian flag. Oh, there was rejoicing. He declared the Quneitra, the Golan, has been freed. And there was only one last Israeli position, a redoubt. You know what the word redoubt means? It's a military term. It means a position. There was one last redoubt. I've been there. It was just on a hill. And the Israelis held it. But they were anticipating a massive Syrian assault. But that's not what happened, because at this point, the tide had shifted. And so the Israelis began pouring forces into the Syrian front. I have a, oh, look at this. I see some numbers here. Wow, I'm so lucky I wrote down numbers. Syria had 600 tanks in the Golan, and Israel had 60 left. So you see the problem there. The Syrians had one front. They concentrated all their forces in the Golan. But by the time the tide shifted, the Syrians were being massacred in large numbers. I have a friend in Aleppo. That's the northern part of Syria. It's the largest city in Syria. And he was young at the time, the age of most of you. And he said he remembered seeing trucks, military trucks, filled with bodies. The bodies piled up so high you could see them sticking out over the top. Scores of these taking bodies to the north of Aleppo. I mean, they're going into the desert and having mass graves. They didn't even have time to figure out who these people were. They're just burying them. It was a catastrophe. And Sadat, Assad and Sadat had made an understanding that neither of them would surrender. They knew what the Israelis wanted to do. They wanted to get one to surrender, and then they could force the other to surrender. So if you get one country to negotiate with them and recognize them, then they can give all sorts of benefits to that country, and then they can give lesser benefits. It's like a betrayal, right? So the Syrians and the Egyptians agreed. Assad and Sadat agreed. And there's a letter, a very sad letter, that Sadat sent to Assad when Egypt agreed to stop fighting. He said, "I'm very sorry, my friend. I know we reached this agreement, but at this point, my country is in great danger, and I have to reach an agreement that I hate. So I am signing an armistice." And that basically left the Syrians exposed. Sadat later said that he forgave him, that he understood why he did that, and he forgave him. But to many Arabs, this was Sadat's first betrayal. He betrayed the Arab cause. The second betrayal was when he signed a treaty with Israel. Because the